Hey, what's up? I'm Vanessa.
I'm Mary.
I'm Gillian.
I'm Rivka, and this is the very latest episode of the Fufu and Tips podcast,
your go-to place for relatable content for the African diaspora down under.
The blacker the podcast, the sweeter the bands.
People shouted my name. I find it rude.
What do they call you?
I've just started working this new job and people are calling me Gil. How dare you?
I hate when they do it too quickly.
I don't even like Gil.
Also, like, let me tell you how to spell my name. Yeah,
just call me. If I like you, I might let you call me G. But most times you won't pass.
But like, let me choose. But I always call you G.
Yeah, but you're my friend. That's different. Oh, okay. But if I work with you,
especially if we're new, like,
then people just call you Gil. Like, no, I don't like that. I really don't.
And also, your name's not long or like it's not like hyphenated.
But I didn't say when I introduced myself. I didn't say, oh, this is my name. You can call me Gil. I said my name's Gillian. Like, I didn't. Anyway,
look, white people know how to say Daenerys Targaryen, so like, they can say our names,
Tchaikovsky and all that.
They can say fictional names. They can say real names.
That's it's true. Just but Aussies do love a good nickname.
Aussies do love it.
Yeah.
Davo, Steve-O, and all that.
When you're adding extra letters to make the name. Yeah.
Or like they'll do a Z, like Mariam will become Maz.
Yes. Yeah. I like it when ethnic people become Aussie like that. Like, I love it. Like,
yeah, then
when
they tell
ethnic
you
people have an Aussie accent, I just love it. It's so cute.
Or when they tell you their name and you're like, that's not even how it's meant to be pronounced, but you're saying it very westernized.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the ethnic brand? Hello, mate. you're so adorable.
That is really
Yeah.
Hello, mate. My dad just thought that cunt is a swear word.
Oh, yeah, really? Yeah.
He was like, one time we were watching watching Australian Open, and this is when I was like 14.
Oh my god.
And he was like, granted, at the time, I don't know if it's the same thing, but in Western Sydney, the C word just flies all the time.
Yep.
So I didn't know it was a swear word either at the time. Yeah. And my dad was like,
I feel like it's your area though.
The area, I grew up in, Western, like deep west. And my dad was watching Australian Open, and Rafael Nadal was coming up, and he was like beating Federer. And he's like, yeah, you know what? We need the young ones to come. All these old cunts, they have to be removed. They have to go.
Yeah, my mom was the same with bullshit.
You know, this bullshit.
No, actually, a swear word. Right?
How much has love?
Bullshit. Wow, so bullshit.
Because I love it in the accent.
It's a swear word. It becomes a word in that language. They're like, oh, what's bullshit?
They love a good bullshit.
So I like it. I love it when I think people like make like Aussie culture their culture.
Because it adds
a bit of spice, like a little bit.
Anyways,
well,
Mary, enjoy editing that out, Mary.
I feel like we could keep that. You know.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah,
we probably can.
Very conversational.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's get an intro. Well, welcome back, guys.
Welcome back.
Hey.
Today's episode is going to feature just one half of our usual hosts. It's myself and Gillian.
Yes, it is.
And two very special guests, Nasalifia.
Hey.
And Tigger.
Hey.
So.
I'm cheering for a different reason. But you know.
Because if you know, you know.
These lovely ladies are from the Melbourne-based therapist practice, Paula Practice. And this is
that
part
was a lot of
our
practice in
I know,
sentence.
It was a lot. Sorry, I really overkilled it with the practice. It's all right. It's all right. And this is part of our collaboration on a series of content that we're doing with them. So hi guys.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
We're very welcome. Thanks for coming all the way up from Melbourne.
I know. Yes. All because of us.
I know. So special.
Sydney. Yep, we're in Sydney.
Sydney. So let's get into it. I want to hear about you guys individuals first, and then we'll get into a deep dive. So, because if you don't mind going first, tell us a bit about yourself, what you do, where you're from.
Okay. My name is Tigist. I'm Ethiopian. I'm going to give you my whole immigration story.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because
we're 95.
Yeah, four actually. So I was born in Sudan and came to Australia through the refugee humanitarian program. Mm-hmm. Originally, we landed in Adelaide, but we don't talk about that horrific time. And my mum was immediately like, "Let's get out of this place."
Was it Sudan?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a huge flight of people that left Adelaide. especially in my community, everyone's just like, yeah, we heard Melbourne's popping. Like, they actually have.
You know what?
Yeah.
There was a huge flight from Sydney as well, like, in the very early 2000s. That's why I have such a huge network down there.
Yeah, huge
flight from Sydney to Melbourne.
Yeah. And
wait,
I think,
what year was this in?
So we arrived in 94 and we moved to Melbourne in 1999. So it was like, I think, and we went to Melbourne because other people were going to Melbourne. And the reason why Melbourne was so attractive for us is because there was a hub of us there. So there was like, community was there, like our churches were there. We actually had restaurants and food and like things that we could access. And especially if you're coming through the humanitarian program, you don't actually have connections. Yeah. Everyone that you're meeting is just kind of like for the first time, and you're trying to establish those connections. And the Melbourne community of Ethiopians and Eritreans have been there since like the 80s.
Yeah.
So you kind of had a bit more of an established community, especially in the southeast, but where I'm west side. And yeah, so I've been in Melbourne since then. I've done all my schooling there. And I'm a counsellor. I've been doing therapy for a while now, both professionally and, you know, not paid as the eldest daughter in my family, the family social worker. And, you know, a lot of the focus that I kind of went down was trauma-focused therapy. So I've worked, my work experiences a lot around people have experienced trauma in various ways. So whether it's through family violence, sexual assault, refugee and asylum seeker trauma, and racial trauma as well. So I will speak about Hannah Salifi and I met maybe a little bit later, because that might have been traumatic. No, it wasn't, but yeah.
Oh, Hannah Salifi, go ahead.
Sorry, I forget this is an audio podcast. And she turns her head.
So I'm Hannah Salifi. I am Zambian born. Left Zambia when I was about 11 with my two younger brothers and parents. We moved to the UK. Initially, we moved to Birmingham, which my parents hated.
Really?
Yeah.
Birmingham.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What was it about? What was it?
They wanted a quiet life. And my parents have always grown up in the city, but I think because they've lived in Lusaka, big cities, their entire lives, they thought they'd go to like country, leave their country to go to a small town.
Yeah, the colonizers' country.
Yeah. We thought, they said it was so great. Britain is so good. We were like, let's go. Also us, let's go. So we were in Birmingham for a bit. And then moved to Wales, so Swansea. Oh,
yeah.
Swansea.
Wow.
Yes. Wins. Very small. Okay. Wins. Yeah. Kamrai. yes. Borada.
What's happening?
Borada. and then my parents thought that was still too big.
Oh, really? And they were living on a farm?
Yes.
The next episode of the story.
Okay, go on.
In Hamilton, New Zealand.
Oh, no way!
And what's Hamilton famously known for?
It's the city of the future, Hamiltron, and the Hamilton Gardens. And they actually live next door. So they finally got their dream after moving us so many times. And they live in a farm area. Our neighbor has, like, their neighbors now have, like, goats and sheep. And across the road is, like, bulls. And, yeah, they really, really wanted...
I should have just came to Ethiopia.
The soft line.
Yeah. So wait, they still live in New Zealand?
Yeah.
Oh.
This is so
And they remarkable. And they love it there?
They love it.
Even like socially?
They love it. They have no intention to leave.
You know what? Another thing I also realize about like people of the South.
Southern.
Yeah.
They don't mind being amongst whites.
Yeah. They really, they don't mind that life. Like the farm life and being excluded. No. Because I cannot imagine in a million years.
Could you imagine?
Even if my dad says he doesn't like people, that he'll go and live in a farm.
Yeah. What?
My mum fled my country.
Literally.
To be with cows.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, in the wilderness.
Right. Yeah. That's why I'm not allowed to go camping.
No,
I've done enough camping for you. Yeah,
it's called refugee camp. Yeah. Like, seriously.
Yes, literally, I'm not allowed to do camping because of that. Yeah. Like,
I think my parents are weird. They also love country music. They're like a little bit strange as...
No, isn't Hamilton known for cults as well? Too. Like that?
Hamilton known... Oh, no, it's our Mormon brothers and sisters. It's the biggest Mormon population outside of Utah.
What? Wow.
Yeah. Hamilton also,
is this place big? No.
Not particularly.
No, but a lot of those section. Mormon populations kind of like rural, rural areas, yeah, because they create their own ecosystem.
And they really do. They there's this place called Temple View, which is where their area.
Yeah, the area. Yeah,
and the thing it's known for is that during Christmas they put up the best Christmas lights. So everyone actually from everywhere in Hamilton will drive there over Christmas
to go and look at it.
To look at the fabulous lights.
I'm not gonna lie, Mormons know how to make a good business.
They really do.
Because I just went to Hawaii and. I went to this place called the Polynesian Cultural Center, and it's like basically six Pacific islands, Fiji, New Zealand, Samoa, Tonga, Tahiti. There's something else, Hawaii. I think that's all six. And they basically recreated like small structures of each island. So they have like an actual traditional house. Like they were telling us, the New Zealand place was telling us how the structure, they actually flew the materials in a flat pack. They had to flat pack it and they rebuilt it, and then you go to each island, you experience it. So there might be like a dance, or there might be like a demonstration or something. Mormon land.
Yeah, but it's a POC version of it, right? So like
there's a lot of POC Mormons.
No, that's what I'm saying. But that's probably why it's nice. Yeah.
But you know what? I feel like a big chunk of POC Mormons are of the from the islands, from the Pacific Islands. Yeah. Polynesians.
Yeah. And they've bare of them. They've done a lot of like mission work as well.
So yes.
So like the people who work there are actually students from the University of Hawaii, and they're all from those islands. So you'll see it, like it will say like they're from Tahiti and stuff. And like I remember this kid, we were in like a canoe thing, and he started talking. And I looked at him and I go, "Where are you from?" And he goes, "New Zealand." I go, "Nah, that accent." And he's like, "Yeah, I used to live in Queensland." And I was like, "Oh, no wonder." I was like, "This makes a lot of sense." And I was like, "But what a beautiful experience for you guys to like now get to move from Australia and like get to experience this." Yeah. But like, I'm just like, at the same time, I'm like, the Mormons did this. The missionaries went in, and they've not. I don't know. It's not exploitation per se. But like you've taken their culture and recreated it and done it yourselves.
But maybe that those Mormons were that did that were of the island, like of that.
No, they. I doubt it, because they also have a mission settlement little island thing in the thing as well.
I mean, maybe they're trying to appeal to their. It's like
it's a target market,
but also accommodating to their base. Do you know what I mean? Would they? Wouldn't it be?
Because the people who go visit,
yeah,
are not. Islanders per se.
Oh, okay.
The people
then
who go
different.
Visit are tourists. Like
maybe they're exploiting their access to that culture. Do you know, is that what you're saying? Like they have access to those cultures, they're exploiting it to make money.
Yeah.
Because they have very deep.
Like it's lovely. It's
like
amazing.
Even in my area, I live in Melbourne's Polynesian population does not compare to Sydney's.
I heard.
It does not even compare.
Polynesian and Lebanese, I think, are the two kind of.
But no, but Polynesians in I feel like the difference is you have more Lebs than you do Polynesian people.
Yeah, but I think
in the
Southeast
we have a ton of Polynesian.
But I think
people.
In Australia, isn't it outside of Lebanon we have the most amount of Lebanese?
Yeah.
I know Greek. In Melbourne they have the most amount of Greek.
Sydney, Bankstown, it's like is literally just Lebanon.
Yeah. Everyone knows that. Everyone knows that, like, the Lebanese population's in Sydney. Mm. But I'm sure that... I think there is a big Polynesian population in Melbourne.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it's bigger
it doesn't
here.
It's there is a subculture here.
Yeah,
like, their
language,
words in their language have become part of Western Sydney
it's
slang.
It's not the same.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That is really cool.
The word usu?
Yeah,
it came from Sydney. Like, that's what all the drill rap and stuff.
They have a huge influence in it.
Anyways, I'm on a tangent. There's in my area, there's a Mormon church. And you know how you always see them walking around, like, in the little outfits?
Yes.
They're always, like, very handsome, very tall Islander boys. Yes. I was like,
I'm about to convert.
Yeah, I know.
What's going on?
But it's very deliberate. Like, people know that, like, they know what they're doing, you know? Yes. They know what they're doing.
That makes sense, because at this resort, like, my cousins were like, oi, don't you want to take that one?
Yeah.
I was like, I don't want a uni student. Come on.
They know what they're doing with that stuff. But anyway, we're on a humongous tangent.
Yeah, I know. Really tangent.
Very interesting.
Please go on.
Yeah.
Go on about Hamilton.
Hamilton, city of the future. It had the highest syphilis rates during my high school time.
What?
Yeah.
The information that's coming out of Hamilton is very concerning.
Hamilton, it's a weird place because there's the Waikato University, which is a great university, especially for bicultural training and everything. And it's huge farming, dairy farming community. And it has the biggest hospital for the North Island, I think. Yeah, it's one of the best. So there's a lot of weird stuff that's been placed there because it's a huge region. It's like Melbourne, Hamilton is like the Melbourne of Victoria.
So so that's where like everybody's coming for services.
It's the hub for that area.
Yeah, but it's great. Close to beaches. I loved Hamilton as a theory. The reality of growing up in Hamilton, being one of, I think, 4 black people in my school.
That's even a lot.
We were doing well. Yeah, it was.
I was one of 3, and I grew up in Melbourne's West.
How were you one of three in Melbourne?
And me and my cousin were like 2 of the 3.
Wait, it's just
the school that I went to.
Was it public or private?
No, it was public, but it just happened to be like everyone went to the other school, and then my school happened to be like the flow over school. So we had a lot of POC and all that kind of stuff. And after my kind of like year and stuff, we had more African students, but a lot more, because I grew up in the St Albans area, so like everyone went to St Albans Secondary, whereas I went to like another secondary that was a little bit in the pocket. So we're still a huge school, 10 year sevens, like 10 classes of year seven.
Wow.
Yeah, and then by the time we graduated, it was like 7 classes of year 12, I think, or 8 classes of year 12. Yeah, so I was like... Really, no one.
So yeah, go on. But
I'm trying to understand how'd you end up here?
Yeah.
So a friend of mine moved to Melbourne for a boy, and while she was doing that, I did my studies in New Zealand and everything. Finished high school there, did uni, started working there. But my parents are pastors, so when I wanted to party. I could hide.
Yeah. Where no one
knew. And have privacy.
Yeah. Right.
Come to Melbourne. Yeah. Yeah.
She flew herself out.
Yeah. She flew down. Yeah. So I'd come see my friend and we'd go out and the like nightlife was unreal.
And obviously incomparable.
It would be like on steroids.
And
fell in love with like the art scene of Melbourne. Mm. And so I got a job. While I was still working in New Zealand, got a job in Melbourne and moved for the job. So Melbourne is the only place I've actually ever chosen to live. Oh. Every other place that I've lived has been because my parents wanted to live on a farm and were slowly downsizing the size of the country that they were living in.
Wow.
So that's how I ended up here. Where are your siblings? My next youngest brother is in Wellington. He just moved out recently from home. He was the last one to move out. And then my baby brother is in Melbourne. So it's a bit of a weird story.
So how did we meet? Is the next question?
Because you said you moved for a job. Was that a counseling therapy kind of job?
It was supposedly, but it was in the justice system.
Okay.
And we all know how that story goes.
Yeah.
And and part of that's the story of Paula psychology initially was because I was working in this job and felt really, really lost a lot of confidence because I was in the spaces where I was challenging particular practices around cultural responsivity and essentially just blatant racism.
It was blatant racism.
Yeah. And I felt so small in that space and felt so like useless and all my skill set was like, I was made to feel so little in that space. So I decided to do private practice on the side as kind of a way to feel like get my confidence back. Mm. That's how Paula's psychology started. And then I think
that was like 2018.
And then at the end of 2018, I had such a long wait list, I couldn't manage it by myself because I was doing it one day a week and maybe a weekend. So I put a post out on Instagram and just asked if anyone knew any therapists. And guess who slid in my DMs?
I slid in the DMs. I was like, hey, girl, what you doing?
Look at that.
Yeah.
So we kind of mirrored each other's stories in a sense. I'd also provided therapeutic care in the justice system as well. And I was also experiencing racism in the workplace and the lack of culturally responsive care, not only to the people that we were treating, but also to me.
Yeah.
And feeling really dehumanized in that space. So I was kind of going through it and I was like, I don't know, questioning my whole career and like, why am I in this? And am I competent enough? And my sister was giving birth. and I found this like post that someone, like it was like a friend of a friend had like shared Nasa Lifia's post. And I was like, oh, let me just reach out. Like, cause I didn't know what to do. Cause like, am I just going to move to another place that's just going to treat me the same? And it was kind of like perfect timing, I think. So she'd reached out. So I reached out and then in the middle of a hospital, right? And then we ended up going on our first date.
Oh, very cute.
We did. And I was trying to be friends. And so I made friend moves.
And I was there like interview, like, yeah, hello, my name is Tiggy. I have a master's in counseling.
Like, and I was like, sis, how are you? How are you doing this? Because
I'm well. I
can I be your friend? And she's like, no, I'm here for the job.
Yeah, I think we realized that Nasalifia was looking for friendship and I was looking for connection. And I thought that if I wasn't like
professional
enough, she wasn't going to go to me. Yeah. Whereas she was like, I'm already talking to you, a professional, let's be friends. And then that started us off on the wrong foot. So we were just kind of like, I was like, I don't think she likes me. And then she's like, I don't think she likes me.
Yeah.
So we were just kind of working as like an impolar psychology. And it was like so funny. Like it was this tiny little room in a
very corporate building.
Yeah, in the city. Because it was one room, we wouldn't even be on there on the same day. And it was just kind of, so we kind of did that for a while.
Wait, so by this time, is this a full-time thing? Because you were saying that you worked at Justice and you were doing it one day.
No, this is both of our side gigs. Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very part-time. Yeah.
How do you bloody manage this?
No.
I can imagine it would be
difficult. So did you think that we were well?
I was wondering. Like,
it was not okay.
No, we worked all the time.
Yeah, and during this time, I was actually working. I was working four jobs. I was working writing reports for Justice. I was working in Shepparton tonight.
Isn't that like a rural place?
Yeah, I was driving and then staying, working in Shepparton, doing the private practice. And also I was working at another private, so I was doing polar practice and then working for another private practice at the time.
And I was doing three jobs.
Yeah.
Oh?
Yeah.
Wait, is it normal as a therapist to be working like that?
Or are you guys just extra?
Yeah.
I think it is normal for therapists not to have like one consistent form of income. Like you can work at multiple practices, but we were being extra.
We were doing the most.
Because I think that the level of distress that we were most likely experiencing meant that we were trying to find somewhere to hold on to.
Yeah.
And trying to find safety means that you kind of, like you're like, oh, maybe I'll try this and I'll try that and I'll try this. And it wasn't until probably like COVID, I think. Yeah.
Yes. So I was driving. I got a promotion in my Shepparton job to work in Seymour, which was at least an hour, not the 2 hour drive that I was doing one day a week.
Oh, closer.
Yeah, it was great. And then on the drive to Seymour, I got into a really, really bad car accident. Ooh. And that slowed me down.
Forced
and then
you to
I was
stop.
Like, why am I working 17 million jobs?
Mm.
And so I was out for a few months doing rehab. And Tiggis held down the fort of polar psychology during that time, but I wouldn't let her visit me.
Look, it was like we had to grow. I think what we learned was that part of the pain that we experienced was kind of like a relational pain, like in these spaces. So we had to build our own kind of, because we're not friends. We don't have any shared experience.
No.
Like in terms of like, it's not like some
our stories are very different.
It's very different. Migration. So we're different parts of Africa. Like there was no, I didn't know her and she didn't know me. And it was, I think through what that happened to you and I stepped up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then COVID happened, which meant that all of a sudden, everyone wanted therapy.
Yes.
And it became like this huge explosive thing. And then we realized we probably, and then the lockdown, hard lockdown of the towers happened.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, you know, quite personal to me, considering I have family there and I've lived in those towers before. And I had families who were locked down in the towers. And I think that brought me and Nasalifia closer together as well. Cause, Nasalifia not being part of that community was like, okay, I need to help through you to make sure that you survive this.
Yeah.
And then I think that's when kind of the concept of polar practice started to slowly evolve. Instead of just being like a typical private practice that's just owned by one person and everyone else is subcontracted, we kind of realized that we want to do individual work, but we want to do community work as well and kind of spread this out because we can't create healing for systemic issues.
Yeah.
Like I can't, like, you know, therapy you out of racism, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. I can help you through that, but I can't, like,
you can't end it. Yeah, yeah. Take it away. You can't CBT the
No, exactly. And that's what we realized. And probably, so that happened like 2020. And then, like, by 2021, we had kind of established a plan for polar practice as something that we both wanted to create together, as to be something a lot bigger than us and a bit of a legacy.
Yeah, and we got really great support from some philanthropy organizations, and we actually had money and time to work on what we wanted to do and what kind of services we wanted to provide. So we actually started developing services for the community, but for us, by us. Uh-huh. Wow. Because that was what we realized during the towers, is that we were so traumatized by what was going on in various ways, mm-hmm. and we actually needed something that was different to what we were seeing. And then we started polar practice. We started doing some more community work that was very intentional, mm-hmm. and then more happened in the world globally. The pandemic was not as short as we thought it would
especially
be,
especially Melbourne's pandemic and lockdowns.
And we realized that actually what we're doing, the one-on-one work we do with the client, is great, and then we can amplify that work by creating safer communities in terms of mental health and amplifying that. But people were going into racist institutions where they worked, so our impact was stopped at that point. So we decided to actually start consulting with organizations to improve their practices around, in quotations, diversity and inclusion.
Mm. You forgot the word equity.
Yeah, equity. Yeah. Yes. So that's kind of where we shifted into these three stages of looking at the system of the places where we spend the most time, which is our place of employment. Yeah. Mm. And then also amplifying the community work, but continuing to do individual work, and then burnt out. Because it was again, we do the most.
Yeah. And then I think we realized that we had to grow in terms of the team.
Yeah.
And I think we had to be really clear about what we wanted to do, because we could do everything. Mm. And I think people wanted us to do everything. Yeah. So we had to be really clear about what our vision was. And our vision was to really work with marginalized identities, mm-hmm. and to be able to provide like world-class mental health and well-being and support for them in mind. Mm. And other people can benefit from that, but that's who...
That's your core.
Yeah, and that's who we are at our core, right? Mm. And I think and our focus has always been on culturally responsive practice. And I think that's something that we're gonna take throughout. So whether it's in the people that we hire, mm. and the people that we consult with, and all the outputs that we have, whether it's a community workshop, whether it's an individual session, whether it's an EAP thing, like, it always has to have those things in mind.
So kind of what's the demographic or of your clientele? Yeah, like,
given the diversity of Melbourne.
Yeah. Right.
So I think it's interesting. We see different kinds of clients. So I tend to see more queer folk who are people of color, mm. and are a lot of them working within the arts space.
Oh, okay.
So that's my kind of the generic client, if I was going to say, is someone who identifies as queer.
Do me.
Yeah.
Who's my generic client? Do me.
Yeah, who identifies as queer or non-binary or gender diverse and is in the arts and really cool, generally, like really cool people. Mm. Yeah, that's my general demographic.
Yeah, I think mine is similar, but it's still like POC largely. Mm. I think when I was looking at like who we see, I think largely the three kind of top racial demographics are going to be African diaspora, First Nations, and South Asian. Mm. They're the biggest populations that come into our service. And in terms of like gender presentation, like non-binary, some trans, but largely a lot of cis women. Mm. And I think the people who I see, and it's not necessarily, I think people, it's just how they refer themselves. I think they look at both of us and someone identifies with someone a little bit more. Mm. I tend to see a lot of neurodiverse folk, and a lot of folk who are in like quite like a career job, like who might be in corporate or something like that. Or thinking about entering those spaces. So I think we kind of see everyone in the end. And especially that now that we have other therapists as well, we kind of, we see everyone, but it's interesting to see who people, like we have this funny joke that we say, someone who kind of presents like me goes to Nasalifia, yeah.
And someone then who someone presents like me goes
to me, and we've just noticed that that's what happens. Like people tend to go to like a different type of personality, because they're searching for something, that's kind of their own internal guidance. It's not us who does that. It's kind of them.
It's
themselves.
Probably like they're looking for something that seems objective. Or like the opposite to that.
Yeah. And I think we all have different skill sets, but we do the same thing in different ways, I think. Yeah.
And like, what kind of issues are, like, what are your top issues that when people are coming to you, what are they discussing?
Because, I mean, Melbourne's got a huge refugee population, I assume. And a hugely, like, the East African community is huge, and that's a hugely traumatized population. Like, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, like these are conflict
ongoing,
heavy.
Like
to ongoing, like to now, like literally there's problems every day in that region. So is do you find that trauma around that experience is most prevalent, or it's more like stuff that's happened, you know, onshore,
or
is
like it a mix existing of both, in existing white spaces,
that kind of thing. What do you think is the dominant?
Do you want to go?
No, you go first.
I think we do a lot of like identity and like origin work. So like family of origin work, which can look different for everyone. So I think the thing that Nasalifi and I noticed is that how people come to Australia is always an interesting thing. So like you're talking about the East African communities, a lot of them come through like a refugee program or like through another family member or something like that. And so that's one way that someone comes in. And then you have people who are like economic migrants who are coming in through work or study, or again through a family member, and they both have kind of skill sets and strengths in their like with the East Africans, there's a strong sense of community. I have people, I have cousins here, and all that kind of stuff. But some of those issues, with identity stuff, might be around like, okay, how do I navigate a family who are quite traditional in this way, and I can't seem to have an identity outside of that, or there has been traumatic experiences in the family that's generational, or you know, whatever the kind of the way that trauma is. Whereas what I found with people who have come through a different way, like an economic migrant, some of that is around loneliness and feeling disconnected, not knowing how, especially if you come older in life, it's so hard. It's really hard. Or if you come in as a uni student and you're like, hey, I got placed in like Wodonga, like, I don't have connections with people, I'm really struggling. And these are established cohorts of people who've been friends since they were 9 years old. So they have their own stuff, which is can parallel and be similar, but like, how they access support and how they've internalized some of those things look different, but the actual content of it is quite similar, I find.
Yeah, because I think it comes down to trauma is a key theme, but it's migration trauma, irrespective of how you come into the space. Because I think, especially it embodied in our stories of how we ended up here, for my family, I know there's trauma in losing connection, losing status in moving, and losing support systems that you didn't have. So parents are then parenting from a deficit perspective because they've lost all these things. They've lost their status, they've lost connection, they've support lost their network. Support networks. So that means they parent in a particular way, and who we end up seeing is the child of that parent. And they're then navigating two worlds of like the culture at home that parents are trying to hold on to, and then the culture in the rest of their lives, the uni culture, work culture. And yeah, navigating those two worlds and how to create identity being of both worlds is kind of the, I guess that's the a general theme that I think most people would come with.
Yeah, yeah. And it's similar, I think. Like, it's just how it looks is a little bit different, how it presents. I think one of the other complexities about living and working in Melbourne is around this, like, multiple identities that you have in the community spaces.
Yes.
Like that kind of, like, public life versus private work. So given that we're quite present on socials, and we believe about being present in the community spaces, whether it's the art space or whether it is kind of like a mental health space or other community events, we find that a lot of the conversations that we have around disclosure and whatnot is kind of like, okay, so what happens if we rock up and we see each other at Footscray both getting our hair done, and you know, and it will happen,
and it does happen,
and the realities are is that because we work with people who look like us, the reality is that that proximity, you might have a cousin, a brother, a friend, or someone that comes to us. So we talk about like how we engage in privacy and confidentiality around that. And there's a level of disclosure when you say, like, oh, that's a therapist. Because first off, you're saying that you've needed mental health support.
Yeah.
And then someone's kind of like biases or beliefs around what that means. And then they're making a connection between, oh, okay, I actually know that you know that. And
yeah.
They're making that. So we've got to really navigate spaces in a particular way, upholding the privacy and the rights of our clientele and people that want to be seen, but also upholding our own rights and ability to be able to like engage in things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
I have a question for you two. Have you ever had a Habesha client?
Yeah.
What was that dynamic like? Was it like, oh.
So I think so I've had the extreme pleasure and the privilege of having multiple Habesha clients, from like elderly to like really young, and I think the benefit of that is like I can speak language. So some people want to speak Amharic, so that's especially the older clients. They really appreciate that, because they're able to, and that looks different for them as well. And I think for the clients who we're speaking English with and whatnot, I think there's from what they've said, feeling seen and being able to understand a particular experience and a particular dynamic that happens in that community, which is very, very specific. And I feel very privileged. Like that's, to be able to serve my community in that capacity, I think I feel very privileged.
I did want to ask if the aunties and uncles and grandparents are coming to you. Just out of curiosity, just because when I think of therapy or black people going to therapy here, in my mind I just think it's young people.
Maybe because
when I think of older people that I know, I just can't imagine them going to therapy.
It's really interesting, and I think it speaks to a particular narrative of Africans in particular not accessing mental health support, which I've found to be completely untrue. People access support where they feel safe. And the thing is, sometimes they don't feel safe in spaces, so they don't access it. But we have a history, like African culture has a history of help seeking. We connect to the elders in our community. We connect to the chiefs in our community.
Yeah, that's true.
We connect to the pastors in our community. We actually, when we have problems, we talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the culture isn't avoidant of help seeking behavior. But we, in this space that we're in the West, sometimes that we don't see ourselves reflected in that person who we're going to. And then that means there's things that we're scared to say. Mm. So then we disengage and we go and find other ways of accessing that support, whether it's through elders that we talk to or pastors or ministers or imams. Or
do you also think that it's also, that help-seeking culture is very native to our culture?
Yes.
But do you think that comes... It kind of gets muddled up in community politics because it's all about keeping up a certain facade.
Or it gets muddled up in religion because we think if we have a problem, just pray and you don't go beyond that. That's the reason why I thought older people might not go, because they'll just be like, if I pray about it, if I go to my pastor,
but it's okay to pray about it, right? So I think like the way I see this is, I think from what Nasalifia is saying, systemically there's a history of blaming Africans for not seeking help. And that is like, that's a racist narrative that is about us in the health system, because it's not true. We do want help. We do seek help. Every time we get surveyed, mental health is always the first thing that we talk about. And it's something our communities want and need. Maybe it's not mental health that looks like white people's mental health, but it is something that we need, right? So I think there's that part of it. And then I think there's a part of it of kind of like, when we talk about well-being and being well and help seeking and trying to engage in wellness. And I think when we think of like how to engage wellness, I think of like, yes, I want your pastor as well. I want the political thing as well, because that's also a way of seeking help. The political agendas that people have is there because they're trying to get justice for something that's going on, right?
Yeah.
Regardless of how problematic it might be, there is a way, there's an intention there to get support, right? And I think when we do, especially a lot of our community work, a lot of it's like, bring all of that in, because we're one part of many things. I don't think it's fair to say our communities need to go into a room by themselves with one person to talk about an issue, because we don't do that like you know, our hazan, when we cry, when we have grief.
People all together.
It's all together. And then you go off by yourself and you might do it, and you might go to a church or a mosque or something, you might do that as well. But there are multiple ways that we engage in wellness, and that needs to be included in our narrative. It's like going to, you know, like the pastor, but as well as talking to my mom, as well as talking to my friend, as well as potentially talking to a therapist and other things. And I think when we talk about this, it has to be like, no, you have to like demonize your pastor. And then it's and you have to go here. Well, it's not. It's kind of like, yeah, we can pray about it. We can also do this.
Yeah.
And that's part of like when we do our workshops. Like one of the workshops is called Let's Talk Mental Health. One of the first things is faith that we put in there, because we understand how like that's the backbone of our communities.
Yeah.
Mm. And some of the other things is like, okay, what's local to you? What's not? What's overseas? Like calling your family overseas. That's also part of your well-being, right?
Yeah.
Making sure that they're okay. So we really believe of like a holistic approach that it is inclusive of all those things, because your pastor has a limitation of what they can
definitely.
Do.
Yeah.
And I do too, because I'm not praying in a session, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
like, you know what I mean? So it's
and
kind
there's
of
value in both.
100%.
Yeah. And especially if you believe it, there's value in engaging with that aspect. Spirituality is really important. And for cultural reasons, spirituality is a key factor that stabilizes us in how we engage.
That's what got them through, I feel. Yes. I feel like that's the reason they're in one piece today.
The first thing they do is they establish
a church, or something.
And they establish schools around that and all that kind of
and community around that. Community and I think the other thing just about like the health system and how we are, the narrative around that is that psychology and mental health is very Western in how it talks about well-being, and it's very individualistic. So the preference is that you do one-on-one therapy, and that is the ideal way to heal, and that is the ideal way to engage in mental health support. We heal collectively.
Back to the Hazan, like the grief process. People come to your house in droves.
And we
heal as a community.
And they connect with you and they relate to you in that way. And a lot of the pain that we experience as communities is relational pain.
Yes.
And relational repair is how we connect.
Yeah.
And I think the whole cycle, the Eurocentricness of it, and even the way like we analyze and we engage in things, it's based off a white man most often
as being the norm,
and their culture being and we're the deviation, and that's not norm for them, whereas there's so many norms in the whole continent that we engage in particular things. So we're big advocates in terms of like we are part of a bigger picture.
I think you've put it quite beautifully, because I feel like that's not the definition that we've been told.
100%.
Mm. So we think other, right? And since you said you're one piece of that bigger picture, it's like, oh, well, then now that I think about it, I do have that in my life. I do have that in my life. It's just this bit of my life I don't have. So I need the extra support in that to balance everything up. So I think, that was nicely put. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
And I think that's like that image is why some of our parents have this perception of therapy being self-indulgent. Why am I just sitting here all alone by myself? I want to share this shit. Our parents drag us and we eat food by ourselves. They're like, why are you sharing?
Yeah, 100%.
So it makes sense for like, why can't I bring my priest here? Why can't I bring my daughter here? It's like so silly to just like, because they don't do one-on-ones in their everyday life. So why should they heal it one-on-one? Do you know what I mean?
And if you think of like how all of our communities came here, regardless of the pathway it is, it was help seeking.
Yeah.
It's like, I want a better life for myself.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go and cross the oceans and go
leave
into places.
The comfort of my country.
And like for like refugee communities, we've walked away from these things.
Literally
it was. So I think I'm like, for you to tell us that we're not help seeking, that it's our problem and that we have taboos around mental health, that's so racist.
Yeah.
Because we're not, we actually care about each other so much that we moved, like that we did all these things for our generations. And it's like, I just go like, no, it's you're the problem.
Yeah.
Yes. And because when we want help, we come in droves. Because anytime there's a black person in any industry, tell me why everyone, Sephora, you're like, is that girl there? Let me talk to her, because there's something that we need that connection, and then we need that safety in order to do anything. And we know that if we're not safe, it's not worth it, because especially with a mental health service, we get pathologized and we get blamed for our issues. We have our kids taken away from us. Mm. We get told that we're a particular thing, and we're disengaged, and we get told, oh, they're very disengaged. They're very angry.
They don't engage with us.
And it's like, what do you mean they don't engage with you? You think that a single mother doesn't want to engage with a service?
When her child is suffering.
Or
when she's crying about
an incarcerated
what's going
child.
On
you don't
kid.
Think she wants to
engaged. Do you think she didn't tell all the like elders because she's proud of this? No, she's trying to get help.
Yeah.
And the thing that you're doing is not helpful.
Yes.
Mm. So she's making a choice of what is helpful and what is safe for me. And I'm realizing that even though that you have this access, I can't get that from you. So I need to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I think there's such a... Yeah.
And I think also the fact that Pool of Practice exists and we have a wait list of people of color.
The wish list.
The wish list.
It's called the wish list.
It's so long. It doesn't make sense for you to say people of color, black people, Africans don't seek out therapy when we clearly do, because we are all on wait lists. And we all, when I seek therapy, the therapist I have is a black woman who I recommend to everyone. So now we have this awkward connection of everyone sees the same therapist.
Yeah.
And these are all black women, black men.
I
think... And it's interesting, we've had conversations with black men in particular, because I think they're told that they don't seek therapy.
Yeah.
All the black men in my life have been to therapy.
Yeah.
Every single one. And most of them may not talk about it out loud because they feel they're going to be shamed, it's not masculine. True. But actually, secretly, they go to therapy.
Mm.
And it's I think that's the thing, is that we don't want the shame of what that might mean or the impact of that, but we actually... actively seek out help at every level and every demographic.
Yep.
But we're not seeking it out in certain places, and they're telling us that we just don't seek out help because we have stigmas around mental health.
Yeah, they really reflect that back onto us.
Yes.
Yes.
I've actually never thought of it that way.
Yeah. They blame us for a systemic issue.
Yes.
Mm. Like,
so true,
but the system isn't set for us. Like,
no.
It's not made for us.
No,
absolutely. So I don't understand how, like, no, I do understand, but I get frustrated that they don't seem to understand that, but obviously they're the ones.
But it's made to continue working, right? Because they'll continuously get funded to engage and access and all that kind of stuff. I'll get like an interpreter for you, or I'll get like maybe one like a community engagement officer. But it's like, you need to change your practices. You need to make this safe when I engage with you. Because once I know that this is safe, I'll tell everyone else to
Know us. Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I'll be the link.
I think this is also like a huge cultural similarity with First Nations people, especially regarding like child safeguarding and everything. It's like, why do you think that your approach is going to work here? Because it's not.
Yep.
Like, it's really not. And it's so even like tenfold with harm for that community, like with children, with custody issues.
Yeah. If you're taking away my child,
why would I come to you?
And literally.
Like, yeah. I'd rather be in an unsafe location with my child than the hopes and wishes that you might treat me well and you might just take away my child.
Yeah.
And also, these services have a history of not being safe.
Yeah.
The
definitely.
Healthcare system has not been safe. It's been you think about a lot of the medication, the skincare that we use, how much of that was tested and is until the last test on humans was in 2012 on black bodies.
Mm.
We test chemicals on black bodies. The healthcare system, you know, the Tuskegee experiment, like there's such a long history of healthcare, Western healthcare systems not being safe for us. So obviously we don't want to necessarily go back to that experience, because this is our experience of this. Yeah. It's only now that you're saying it's safe, because last year you were testing, you know, I think in Africa, I think there's a Kenyan experiment around birth control.
Yeah.
And false sterilization of women to test out how to sterilize on black bodies.
Mm.
So I think it's such an irony that we are blamed for not accessing services that have never been safe.
Yeah.
Mm.
That you're now saying should
be
safe.
When you again and again have shown us that you don't have our best interests at heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And we're not taken as like the knowledge that we have in terms of wellness or all that kind of stuff is not seen as knowledge. It's like you're telling me how to look after me when I got myself here. I got myself here. Like, and you're telling me that knowledge is, I should push it away. It's insignificant. You're
assimilate.
Not seeing, and you're not treating the knowledge that I have as fundamental to my survival and the reason I was able to thrive in a place that's completely existed for me to die in.
Mm.
So, like, how am I supposed to then engage it with you? And I think our communities don't say it that way, but our behavior shows it.
Mm.
And the way we move shows it. And the way we protect each other and look after each other and create pockets of safety within community shows it.
Mm.
Yeah.
That is such an incredibly, like, it's a perspective that's merged two things there, like as in like my cultural perspective and like the reality. It's like almost like they're incompatible, like psychological well-being and like my culture, they're at odds. Mm. But actually it's not, like our people have had practices that safeguard psychological well-being. I think it's treated often as like silly folklore or like silly, you know, like little remedies or whatever, but actually it's...
And then they're repackaged and called mindfulness that was discovered by white men.
Or like drumming.
Yeah.
On beats, you know, like what?
EMDR, that tapping,
you know? It's repackaged. Yeah. It's our stuff. Yeah. We did that. That's our thing. We've been doing that. Like yoga.
Hinduism's been completely repackaged.
Oh, come like, on.
That is completely ripped off. And they were like called like pagan evil, whatever. Yes. By them. And then now it's like, mindfulness, meditation, this, that. It's like, babes.
I think, we mentioned Hazen, which is the name for how we do our grief ceremonies. That was like repackaged as like, what was it called? Like group exposure, grief exposure or something. And then it was told by psychologists that it's actually not helpful for grief. And I was so personally offended by it because like this has existed in my culture for thousands of years. And like one of the biggest risks for our community is experiencing death alone. Right? Experiencing death without community and having people come to you. And we have whole ceremonies about how you tell someone that someone can't do it at night. Yeah. Yeah. You have to do it in a particular... And for like a whole journal to come out and say that this is not psychologically safe and does not help with grief, I was like, what do you mean? Who did you talk to? Because maybe for a community that's individualistic, everyone crying together doesn't make sense. But like for us, that helps us grieve and helps us connect, and like to have an auntie crying about your mom as if it was her mom and the way we can, and then because it's not just about the crying, it's about the stories that are told afterwards and the food that happens and then and this happens like cross religions as well. So you will have the same cultural practice both in Christian and Islam, right, in a country. So like to read these articles when I was like studying, I was so personally like, I was like, oh, I'm learning real quick that this, like some of these psychological practices, I've just got to ignore because it's actually not, who did you talk to about this? Because this is not true. It's not true that communal healing in grief does not work and is more psychologically damaging for people. 100%. Like to read that's psychologically damaging.
That's so interesting because the global majority grieves that way.
Yes. The whole world grieves that.
Yeah, there's a small group of people that
are the ones out. Yeah, we actually are the majority. They are the odd ones out. They are actually weird for being so individualistic. Yes.
In their grief.
We are the majority.
Yes. Yes.
You ask any person from the global south, even the Mediterranean, like even like Greeks and stuff who are white technically.
Yeah. But they have their own mourning practices.
Yeah. They all wear black and cry for 40 days.
Yes.
Those grieving periods, those milestones that you mark, it's global.
They have clothes that they wear. Yeah. They have like...
The Italians, if the husband dies, she wears black for the rest of her
life. Yeah. But there's practices in that that you're just ignoring. Yeah. And you're saying, and you're making a blind sweeping statement that this is not okay. Mm. So then imagine that when you, as a person of color, going into a therapist and being like, oh, you know, so-and-so died and all my, that's not helpful. And da-da-da. Mm. And it's like, well, like, you know,
it that, actually that was.
That influences how we're treated and how we're pathologized because who you researched is being used on me, but it's not reflective of me. Right? And when we do our research, the first thing that we're asking people is like, oh, who are you connected with? Because some people are not connected to their families or not connected to their communities, but they've had other things.
They've got chosen families.
They've got chosen families, chosen communities.
So even for queer community, chosen family is a thing. So even they collectively come together and do pride. Where there's which was a protest initially, but they do collective healing as anyone who's marginalized. We all do it in the same way.
Yes,
but because there's safety together. Group of people.
It's just like, and that's the norm, and that's what we get told, and it's just like, but it doesn't. Yeah, it's like fact checking these things. It's not true.
You must have driven you insane.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes,
I can see it.
It was probably worse for her.
Yeah. Like, because you did a master. You both have.
But she did like a clinical program. Yeah. So it was like because as a clinical psychologist. It was at
Waikato Uni, which I must say actually has Māori practitioners, and they teach from a tikanga Māori perspective. It is a side note, but it's there and. It's so interesting at uni, me and a group, so I had a Māori friend, a South Korean friend, and me, and we were the most problematic, loud-ass people.
I
because
love that, the three of you.
Yeah, because we found each other and we're like, okay, so we're going to cause trouble, yeah? We're going to talk, we're going to speak up about the bullshit that we're being told, pardon my language. but yeah, so uni was hard. And the only way I survived was I had a collective of other women with similar experiences to heal through. And that's how I completed the clinical program.
Yeah. So during my master's, I had like a year placement that I had to do to get my hours. And I was like, when I did my undergrad, I felt so under-supported. I reached out multiple times to like the head lecturers to get kind of like support and trying to get placement. And then by the time I graduated, I didn't get all that. And then I really struggled to find a job. So in my master's, I was like we had a whole family meeting. We're like, we're going to focus all this because this is what I want to do. And I was so privileged that my family were like, we'll support you through this. I dropped down and I was like, I'm going to be studying and doing my placement. And then I'll do like one job a week that covers like petrol or something like that, right? And my family were like, we will support you because, you know, it happens at events every week. Yeah. So they're like, we'll cover you for that just for the year while you do this. And I'm so glad I got to because I ended up doing a placement in like an area called Melton, which is like very, very diverse. It's like, I was like, I specifically chose to work in a space that was where our kids are, right? Whether it's Pacific children, African children, other POC children. And I ended up doing like high level work as a placement student I shouldn't have done. I became the cultural liaison. I was doing more hours than I should have. I had no support at all. After that, I was so unwell because there was no containment for me.
Yeah.
There was no one supporting me through this. There was no, like my supervisors, like in my class and whatnot, like they were, I got more cultural experience and knowledge myself and having to Google things myself and self-learning than I did in my course where the teachers, like one of the teachers got a complaint made by students because he was made fun of someone's accent. And like, you know, that's the type of...
The teacher did that.
Yeah.
Oh, he should be sacked.
Yeah, like he was making a psychology teacher made fun of someone who was an international student who had an accent in the middle of class. That's the level of like psychological harm that was happening in this. I remember when I was doing one of my it was like one of these assessments that we had to do where you kind of like interview each other and act like clients. And I remember I had to make a complaint about the person I worked with because they specifically like went out of their way to make me fail. They're like, I want to give you a really cut. And they kept changing. And like, it was like the level of harm that happens to us in these spaces because we're not humanized.
Yeah.
And like the things that we have to do to kind of safeguard that is the things that I eventually were the foundations of what made us do the work that we had to do. Because it was just so, it was so difficult.
But so how does one go about accessing polar practice or just even accessing like services in general, like mental health services, therapy, et cetera, et cetera?
Do you want to do quick fire so that we get the information out? I'm happy for you to do quick fire.
Quick fire as in like the, okay, so I'm just going to...
Step by step, yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to say what I think you're...
Yeah. Read my mind.
So I think that there's multiple ways that people can get support, right? Mm-hmm. So you can get your support through... like social services and whatnot, depending on your area. But the most common way that people get mental health support is through a GP referral to a private practice. So while there are services that are specific to a particular thing, like there's sexual assault services, family violence services, the most common way that people get services is through private practice mental health support. So that's probably the fastest way for general mental health support. There is crisis services. But I don't think that's what we're talking about right now, right? So in terms of how to get support through polar practice, the work that we do is international. It's not Australia-based. It's also in New Zealand. We've had clients who've lived in America as well who have accessed our services. So we have a big thing around this accessibility. So we're available both online and face-to-face in person. And the best way to get into contact with us is info@polarpractice.com.au. or our website, polarpractice.com.au. And our services are both through Medicare for some people, but self-funded as well.
Yep.
And some people get NDIS funding as well. So we are, one of the things that we learned was that there needs to be a way to hold people especially because of our wish list that, yep. that Natalie mm-hmm. talked about. So one thing that we changed when we became a practice is now that we have an intake process that allows us to meet someone, ask them questions, and kind of assess what their needs are and support them in terms of like, okay, this is who we think would be best for you and this is how long it will potentially take. So they have a response and then they'll be added either to a wait list or added to the client that we think is, to the therapist that we think matches them.
Yeah, and one of the things that we have on the website, not just our therapists, we also have a therapist directory, which is a group of other therapists that are not affiliated with us, but other great therapists. My therapist is on that list, and she's great. And yeah, people can access that. The other way is through Psychology Today, which is a great website because you can filter your search, which can be, you can look for someone who works in a particular area in a particular way. So that those are two pretty great
online
options.
Resources.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Kemi, are we allowed to
go? Yeah, go. You're asking permission. Please, can I do this Reddit, please?
So we have a segment called Reddit Reactions at the end of each episode, where we read out a scenario from the Am I the Asshole page. I don't know if you guys are familiar.
I love that page.
Yes. And I feel like it's appropriate because this is the one's about drawing boundaries. And, you know, of course, you guys are in the psychology space, especially in families that like ours that can have things like enmeshment.
And what boundary?
What's his boundary? So I'm going to read it out and, you know, give us your thoughts.
Okay.
Just going to get my giggles out.
The title, Am I the Asshole for Not Letting My Miracle Baby Niece Be My Flower Girl at My Wedding?
I love the drama. All right, I love the family drama.
My 27 female, older brother, and sister-in-law, both mid-30s, just welcomed their first child a year and a half ago after years and years of trying. After many failed attempts, sister-in-law was told she wouldn't be able to conceive due to a medical condition she has, then they finally got pregnant. Since having my niece, the baby has been the center of attention at every family event. We've been that since she's been born. Birthdays, weddings, family get-togethers, you name it. I love my niece, but it can be a little too much when my sister-in-law goes on and on about how long they tried to conceive, complications they've had, miscarriages, etc. So it's a little bit too much info. Anyway, I'm getting married in the spring and my brother and sister-in-law approached me last weekend about my niece being the flower girl. Now my fiance, 35 male, already has two children from a previous marriage, 10-year-old male and a 6-year-old female. His son is one of his groomsmen and his daughter asked to be our flower girl when we told him the news that we were getting married. It's something she always wanted to do, so of course we said yes. I explained to my sister-in-law when she asked me about my niece. She asked if my stepdaughter can carry my niece with her. I said, I don't think she'd be comfortable with that considering she's 6.
She went, drop her.
Bro, mash up your daughter, bro. She then asked why I can't give that role to my niece and allow herself to carry my niece down as the flower girl. I said no, because I already promised my stepdaughter. She then started going off about how my lack of effort to incorporate my niece is disgusting to her. I should honour her in some way since I know how long and hard they tried for my niece. Now, I may sound like an arsehole for this, but I kind of got fed up and snapped and said, incorporate my niece how? By the time the wedding comes around, she'll be 2 years old. The entire family already knows your story about how long and hard you guys tried to have her. What more do you expect me to do to honour her? She started crying and said that I clearly don't love my niece and I'm letting her down. I said, of course I love my niece, but obviously she's going to be involved in pictures and stuff. But I'm not going to let my stepdaughter down by giving my niece a role she's too young to remember anyway. Well, now they're both pissed off at me for not letting my niece be flower girl. My mum has been trying to stay neutral, but thinks my stepdaughter would understand if I explained it to her and gave that role to my niece. I am firming my decision, and my fiancé is thankful I didn't let his daughter down. Am I the arsehole for not letting my niece be the flower girl?
No.
The stepdaughter won't understand. Are you serious?
No.
The stepdaughter's 10, and I feel like...
And that relationship is more important.
Very. Yes.
And she's going to remember.
Yes.
And for the partner as well. Yeah. Like, it's important for the partner.
And especially as a step... parent.
You have to try. You have to really try.
You really
do. Yeah. When you look back, you know.
Yeah.
No. It doesn't make sense why the stepdaughter wasn't involved in the wedding, but the niece was.
Yeah.
In 10 years' time. Like, when you look back on that.
The niece will not remember. She's too.
It's also why we won't even walk down because she'll be freaked out anyway. Yeah,
when they're too young. I hate when flower girls are too young.
So no, yeah. That's cute. I'm not going to lie.
No, but then they'll pee themselves. Or not pee themselves. Nah. Like,
even seven, water, six, I'm like, yeah. Like.
Eight.
Yeah, like
eight. Yeah,
like even the age of the stepdaughter, I'm like, oh my god, she needs, because kids, it's overwhelming to walk down and be a flower girl. It's not a normal thing that you do in everyday life. So
they always cry on their birthday.
Yeah, too much. Like, a lot of kids get overwhelmed and like the parent has to help them and all that kind of stuff. So, and that's difficult for a 5 to 8, 9 year
people
old.
People love that. They think it's so cute when the kid doesn't walk. It's like, oh, the kid didn't walk. And then an auntie goes and helps them or something.
Yeah, it's cute for like a minute. Yeah, and then you're like, okay, let's move on. Sometimes
they suck. I went to a wedding where the boy, like little boy is 2, is a ring bearer. Oh. He like chucked it. It was so, and he started crying in a tantrum. Yeah. And he was crying with the music. It's just too chaotic.
Mate, they would have known that kid
would want to do it. But just be in the photos.
Be in the photos.
Yeah, be in the photos. I think that's a nice way to memorialize that.
Mm. Yeah, like even the dress and just put her in the photo.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, exactly. Just put her in a cute dress.
Yeah.
So my controversial opinion that my family do not like is that I don't want any ring bearers, because we're so extra. We have ring bearer, we have candle holder. And flower girls. Like, I don't want any of that on like the ceremony. I don't mind it for the photos and like when we do house photos or whatever, da, 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 but I don't want that in a ceremony.
I feel like that's all right. I don't want bridesmaids and people tell me.
Yeah, same. I wouldn't like that either.
You don't want bridesmaids?
No, I do.
Oh, okay. It can be a bit political with bridesmaids.
I just don't think it's necessary.
I think it's better when you just don't do bridesmaids at all. Then you end up just, you know, people are like, I just want one. And it's like, oh, that's more problematic.
I can have one. When I'll just have my goddaughter.
Yeah.
Yes.
She can walk me down. Oh, that's it.
I think that's beautiful. I think when you do nothing or the people that are important to you, you can't just try and do one.
Yeah. I feel like, if it's your sister. Then it's okay.
Yeah, but see, I don't have sisters.
Okay, if you have one sister, yeah.
Yeah,
If you have a sister, that's
yeah,
that,
or
that
one passes. Sister, one brother, that's fine. Yeah, that also right? Passes. But like, you can't, if you have like multiple siblings or multiple family members or a big group of friends, I think you're better off doing nothing, like you said. Like, just
do it. So, are people annoyed that you don't want the candle bearers and flower girls?
Yeah, they're like, but what do you mean they make the program nice? I'm like, it really doesn't. Like, our cultural programs are loud.
Two shamayaji, isn't it?
Yeah, so yeah, candle holders. Yeah.
You have two little girls holding candles.
No, because I'll tell you the procession, right? So, yeah, it was so extra. We have a little kid that holds the ring, and that only came in since the 2000s, right?
Yeah.
So you have a kid that holds the ring, and then you have two kids, usually it's a boy and girl, who hold the candle. So it's a candle with a big ribbon, and they walk down.
Are they lit? Are the candles lit?
Look, it depends how much you want to traumatize the children, right? Yeah. Right? Yeah. So they used to be, but now they're like, flammable. So it depends,
OH&S.
Right?
OH&S.
Yeah, OH&S. And then after that, you have flower girls.
Girls, plural.
Yeah, so you have two flower girls.
And sometimes they're too grown, aren't they? Like sometimes we have like 14-year-old flower girls.
Yeah, because flower girls for us are like adolescents.
Yeah.
Because you have to be not big enough to have big boobs or anything like that. You have to be like 10, 11. 14, like 12, 13. Because it's really weird. That's why I'm like, I just don't want them. Like I have enough little kids. And who am I going to pick in my family?
Yeah.
Which kid am I going to prioritize? Instead, what I'd rather do is be like, all the kids can wear a white dress, all that, like, and they can have a big photo with the bride and all that kind of stuff. Fine. You know what I mean? Have their memorable kind of thing at the, because we do a whole house thing. Do that at the house. Leave me alone at the reception.
Yeah.
I think that I'm more egalitarian in that way.
Okay. What about you, Natalie?
I'm getting married soon and I have bridesmaids. Thank you. I have no bridesmaids, no groomsmen, and maybe one flower girl.
Yeah.
Actually, not maybe.
I really love that.
Just in case
you.
My niece actually. My sister-in-law hears this. I definitely have one flower girl. But that's it. Because I think weddings are so personal and they become family affairs.
That's what I think.
I actually think someone who's not a particular romantic, I always thought it was so weird that I'm watching you guys get married. I'm like, isn't this private? It feels like a private moment.
Oh my gosh. That I'm Thank God that I've met you. Yeah. Because, no, seriously, that's what I think in my head.
Yeah.
But everyone thinks I'm crazy. But I'm like, I just...
to be honest, I don't want any of you to be there because I just do you know feel like it's me and I him. Can't relate. Like, yeah. You don't I can't need relate. To be there.
Everyone
like,
must see my dress, pardon.
I was like, the East African in me is like, I need 7,000 people at my wedding.
Yeah, see, I don't think that, and I know people think it's crazy because they're like, but you know so many people, like you have so many friends. But I was like, I don't even freaking care because at the end of the day, it's just going to be me and my men. None of you are going to be in our room. None of you are going to be in my house. Like, I just don't see why I should make this a big thing.
Ethnics have, it's because like, that's because you're marrying for love, but our cultures didn't originate.
Yeah.
Our cultures had like, this is an amazing business exchange. Let's shake hands and have a party. That's what weddings are for us culturally.
Yeah, well, and we're joining families and like, let everybody see that we're joining. Yeah,
which is why they're selfish. They talk during the speeches. They eat all that. They bring their kids to the toilet to bring their kids. They're selfish with it because they think it's the party is thrown for the guests. They don't actually not there to witness.
So like traditionally, it's like there's this thing around like if you go to like the rural areas, it's like I'm hosting you.
Yeah.
Right. So I like gibja. So it's like I'm looking after you, and when you as like an elder go to all these people's houses and they've taken care of you, and when it's time for your kid, you have to return that favor.
Yeah.
So for me, I've always said my wedding and all the wedding related ceremonies is for my parents, is for my mom, it's for her pride in her community and her pride in that.
Yeah. Mm.
But see, we're really traditional in the sense that my mom would cook all the food. Like, she would be, she'll be like, I'm catering the whole thing. And that's like, she would be so upset if I went and got like a catered thing for her wedding.
Yeah. Because
she's still got that mindset of like, I need to like give back to all the people who have hosted me.
Mm. And who invite.
She's like hosted. So like she's got that. So I've grown with that.
I understand that cultural thing. I understand that significance.
Yeah.
The vow thing, I don't need y'all be there because the vow thing is not us out. That's not what we did in our culture. The culture was the traditional engagement we call it traditional engagement, but the cultural thing was like when they do the listing and they bring the gifts and everybody's there. Cool,
the ceremonies.
That's fine.
Yeah.
The other bit, the white bit, the Western bit that we've all decided to adopt, I don't freaking want that.
I agree. I think that's fine. I think you can have intimacy in small moments and then you can have exact moments. Yeah. And I think people try to co-opt both. Or say that both are not, like, both have to be one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. Or they tell you have to do both. Like, otherwise it's not a wedding. It's like, no, you've just made that up. Like, you've just added things into it.
There's, like, there's no vows in the Orthodox ceremony, is there?
The vows that you were given are the vows that, like, that you read from the Bible.
Yeah.
There's no, like, remix of my vows.
But, like, when we have a traditional one, there are no vows. Like,
Those vows are very Western. Because, like, not Western, but modern, like,
or like in the church, in the church one,
For us in our church, there's none of the like.
Like you know how you sit there and be like, "I love you," so and so. Yeah, like we don't remix it. We're like whatever's on the thing is what you say.
Obey this that no.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah,
very. Okay. It's more like actually like a prayerful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, but with us, cause a lot of time we're with a person 4 or 5 years. There's so much building up to it.
Yeah.
And all of that. And so you want to express
that. Yeah, of course,
It's so personal. I get why you want to make it private.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But traditionally, there is none of that. Like, your parents decided who you were going to marry. So it's like, you know.
And I love it when people can figure out how they can merge these things, right? So you're saying like, hey, you know what? This vow situation is really intimate. And I think I only want that with like, people who I want to be vulnerable and intimate with in that way.
Yeah.
And then maybe like the other side, the cultural side, I can be a little bit more like,
yeah.
You know, I can be community facing, public facing.
Everyone can be there, whatever.
Yeah. Mm. And I think that's a fair enough thing to want and to desire. Yeah.
Well, thank God we have this recorded so I can play it back to everybody that pissed me off about
it. Well, back to our old mate on Reddit. What do you reckon she should do with her very self-entitled
sister? Oh, wow. I thought we finished.
I didn't come down to it.
This one's like, so my wedding, I just want to go back to
me personally.
Can you just direct this to my mom?
We're still going back.
I didn't finish it, babe.
Because you're all finished.
Sorry.
Yeah, you got my advice.
I'm done. I'm good.
I think, so I have this view on boundaries. You don't have to share your boundary with other people. You just have to hold your boundary.
Enforce it.
Yeah. I think if I tell you, my boundary is X, Y, and Z, then I'm placing it on you to maintain it. I actually have to maintain it. So my boundary for this person would be, say no, and say nothing else. No is a full sentence.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because the problem is we start then debating, and then what we do is we actually give the other person permission to negotiate with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
if the answer is no, there's no negotiation. It's just, no, babe.
Yeah.
Full stop.
I think like that reimagining of what boundaries means, because I think it's one of those words in like that's in the pop culture.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of like been filtered. And I think for me, the way I've explained that is instead of saying to someone, you can't talk to me that way,
mm-hmm.
it's like I am not going to engage with people who talk to me that
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
So it's returning it back to you. And I think boundaries are only as good as they're enforced.
Yeah.
So if this person is, they are going to badger and they're going to keep pushing and all that kind of stuff. And I think if they're able to stay and be like, no, I've already said what I've said and I've explained the job, like even though they didn't have to, they've explained and they've, you know, created a reason. And it's obvious what the reason is. Yeah. And then the wedding will pass and that person's just going to realize that through your behaviors and actions, you've shown that like, yeah, you can think that your child is the center of your world and that's okay. And I love and respect that child, but they're not the center of my world. Mm. And that doesn't disrespect the child. Yeah. It just means that like I have other things that center my world and my partner is that person.
Yeah.
And if for my partner, it's more like, you know, so
yeah.
I think sometimes our behavior also reinforces the messages that we're trying to have and being consistent about our behavior consistently shows, you know, what is important to us and what we're.
And also it's okay for people to have feelings about your boundaries.
Yeah.
Like people can be hurt and that's okay. Those are their feelings and they can sit with that.
Yeah. And they can be upset and cry and do that.
Because their feelings are valid, but that doesn't mean your boundary has to shift.
Yeah.
The boundary is what it is. I've said no. I'm sorry you're hurt, but it's still no.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that you feel blah, 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 but it's still no. And that's it.
Because
that's what setting a boundary is saying that you can have feelings about this, but this is what my stance and I'm not shifting. But you are allowed to feel whatever you feel about it, but I am not shifting. That is a boundary. Otherwise, it's a negotiation.
Mm. Yeah. And that will create a better impact on their family.
Yeah.
And it will create a better kind of shift of kind of like how to engage than this person changing their mind and doing the thing that's like, I'm just going to appease and please. Yeah.
Mm. And we set boundaries so that we can maintain the relationship.
Yeah.
So that I don't resent you for making, like forcing me to have my niece be
on
there.
On my wedding day.
Mm. Yeah.
On this one day.
I don't want to resent you, so I'm going to say no so that I don't resent you.
Yeah.
And we can maintain a healthy, loving relationship. And that's it.
Tea.
Yeah.
That was great.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You turned a Misa into a full episode. That's how
I know, right?
Dope this was. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Where can we find you on socials?
Yeah.
At Polar Practice on Insta, at Polar Practice on Twitter. Even though we've tweeted nothing.
I didn't know we had a Twitter.
Now you know.
Yeah. We do. but I think the best place is Instagram or LinkedIn and our website. Yeah.
Cool. Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank
you. Bye.
That was amazing.